sneak in every few weeks," she sighed. "I thought I was being pretty discreet. Guess not." "That doesn't count. It might seem like fun at the time, but trust me, it doesn't last. When was the last time you even went on a proper date?" I couldn't remember. My life had been much easier to sugarcoat when Ali was living at the other end of the country. But now she was living with me, there was no hiding the truth. I was in a bit of a rut. Saving like hell, putting all my energy into overtime shifts on the ward. I had my goal of buying a home well within my sights, but at what cost? Spending my 20s working myself to exhaustion. I tried to shrug Ali's comments off, but her words had stung. And so I was proving her wrong by driving Ali's car on a date Ali had organised with a woman I had very little interest in. A nerve was definitely hit. I parked outside a quiet cafe. Naomi looked at me, puzzled. "Ali said we were going to dinner." Crap. She probably did. When it came to anything outside of the hospital walls, my attention span was shorter than my best power nap. This served me right for not stepping up and arranging the date myself. "Ugh." I apologised. "I think there may have been a few crossed wires. I ate already." "Oh," she pouted. "I haven't eaten since breakfast waiting for this." That was when I realised that this date meant significantly more to her than it did to me. Which made me feel horrendous. First dates were awkward enough without the other person showing a blatant disinterest. "But I can always eat more," I said. "There's a good pizza place that way, or..." I pointed along the road. Naomi was already climbing out of the car. "I have somewhere better in mind." She took my hand, which felt a bit forward, and we walked past the Buttercross Monument and up the hill, stopping at a little restaurant. Le Bleu. French. Romantic. The menu displayed outside didn't have any prices on it, and I knew exactly what that meant. That my £50 budget for this day was about to be blown out of the water. Naomi looked so excited when the maitre d' said they could sit us within the hour, and I barely had the energy to contest it after a hard few days on the ward, so I took a seat at the bar. Naomi wanted to order a bottle of wine, and when I explained that I didn't really drink alcohol, she kept asking me why, teasing me about being boring. Sure, I could have told her the truth, that for a long time, alcohol had been my favourite off switch, that it was the reason I took 4 years to complete a 3-year degree, but that felt too personal. So I said it was for health reasons and steered the conversation towards her job. She was much chattier than she'd been at the party, going on and on about a huge weather front that was coming in next week. It was interesting at first, but after 30 minutes of being lectured on wind speeds and synoptic charts, I felt like I was revising for my geography GCSE. It was late by the time we were seated. The waiter lit a candle between us. Naomi picked up a menu, scanning for a moment before flicking her eyes back to me. "Wow, it's so expensive here," she said. I twitched in my seat. Damn straight. 3 figures for steak and chips, shitting hell. "This month has been one of those months, you know," she said. "Rent, utilities, yada yada. And then my washing machine broke and they charged me £100 just to send someone out to look at the thing. And then..." I knew exactly what she was hinting at. "My treat," I said. "Oh, man." She smiled, reaching across the table to take my hand. I thought she was about to thank me, when instead she said, "Doctors make good money, right?" "They do," But I'm a nurse. Close enough. And with that, she ordered a charcuterie starter, followed by the Chateaubriand with a lobster side and another glass of wine. I ordered a salad and a sparkling water. She must have noticed the nervous sweat starting to glisten my forehead at the expense, because she smiled reassuringly. Don't worry, I totally have a plan. Our food arrived, and we ate while chatting about our university days, living in Southampton, the bars we loved, the student housing that should have been condemned decades earlier. Naomi was smart and focused. And yeah, she was hot. It had been about 3 weeks since I'd got laid, and so for 30 minutes, at least, I put aside the fact this meal might possibly bankrupt me, and instead focused on the cute ways she laughed at my jokes and how she seemed genuinely interested when I spoke about my job. I started to enjoy myself a little bit, until the waiter came to clear our plates. "I'd like to speak to the manager," Naomi said, her soft voice turning stern. "Was there a problem?" the waiter asked, looking between us as if I had a clue what the hell was going on. She folded a napkin and slammed it on the table. "Yes. Yes, there was. I need to speak to the manager immediately." The young waiter stuttered. "He's not here. There's no management in today. They're on a training course." "A training course," Naomi puffed. "Not surprised." "I can get you the chef," he offered by way of consolation. "Perfect." The waiter disappeared behind two swinging doors. "What are you doing?" I asked Naomi, utterly baffled. "Saving you a small fortune." She smirked and a looming dread set in. It worsened the moment I caught sight of the chef walking towards us. This could not be happening. Grace, the caterer. She wore a white chef's jacket, a big splodge of red sauce on her left arm, a burn mark on the sleeve. Her hair was tucked messily under a hairnet thing, and she looked absolutely miserable, despite the bright customer service smile she forced across her face. "Hi, I'm Grace, the chef today. Is there something I can help you with this evening?" She looked directly at Naomi, and at first, I wasn't sure if she recognized me from the night I'd begged to get her number, told her that her heart was in good hands with me and then never followed through, or if she did, and was now making a conscious effort to ignore me. I didn't know which would be worse. "Yes," Naomi sat straighter, clearly empowered by what she was about to do. "Like, not being funny, but this food is really overpriced." I stared longingly at the window. It would be less painful to run through it like a cartoon superhero. Grace looked at me, expressionless, then back at a smiling Naomi. "I'm sorry you feel that way." "I do feel that way," Naomi said, raising her voice enough that the people on the nearby tables started looking over. "My chips were cold, the spinach had some weird garlicky goo mixed in with it, the lobster tail was slimy, and my steak was way undercooked." She stabbed a sliver of pink meat and lifted it until it was right under Grace's nose. "This is not medium rare. This is rare. And I don't eat rare steak." My insides convulsed. Mine was great," I said. Naomi threw daggers with her eyes. "We want it off the bill." "Off the bill?" Grace's tone was as cold as Naomi claimed her fries were. "But you ate most of it." "I did not," Naomi bit back. "The customer is always right, and anyone can see there is still food on this plate. She lifted it to the watchful eyes of the rest of the restaurant. The remaining scraps wouldn't have satiated a toddler, yet Naomi persisted like she had an entire buffet in front of her. See? Food. And I'll be lucky if I don't get food poisoning from what I did eat. What's the hygiene rating of this place? Everyone was watching to see Grace's reaction. Whispers from the other tables pulled my focus. One stuck out. That poor girl. Grace sucked in a breath, and the low romantic lighting hit her differently. It was the type of ambience that made everything softer, smoother. But from where I sat, Grace looked like a woman on the edge. She'd clearly had a night from hell and was one difficult customer away from snapping. She cleared her throat. Given the amount you've consumed, and that you left it until after the meal to vocalize your concerns, the best I can do is offer you a complimentary dessert. Naomi looked at me and scoffed. I wouldn't eat another bite if you paid me. Everything about Grace was composed and professional, except for her bottom lip. It quivered. She closed her eyes. I couldn't take another second of this. I pulled my credit card from my wallet and put it in Grace's palm. Her eyes connected with mine. Please put everything on here, plus tip. Grace nodded once, handed my card to the nervous waiter from earlier, and walked back into the kitchen. I paid more for that meal than I had for the last 3 months' electricity. Naomi was livid. Why did you do that? We totally had them. I called her rude and obnoxious, and she accused me of being an idiot, said I needed a rude awakening to how the service industry really worked and that she was never going to pay me back. Whatever. We parted ways on the street, with her flipping her middle finger at me before walking into a bar a few doors down. I half thought about giving the bouncer a heads up, making sure she paid up front. But not my circus. Not my monkeys. I waited outside Le Bleu. They were close to closing, with most tables empty now, a few couples finishing shared desserts. I should have gone home. The embarrassment of what had happened with Naomi should have made me too ashamed to show my face near that place ever again. But it didn't. I opened the restaurant door. The bell above it alerted everyone to my return. The waiter looked like he might weep. I showed my palms, a pledge of peace, and took a seat at the bar. The bartender eyed me wearily as she polished glasses. I couldn't insult this place further by ordering a water, so I asked for an overpriced bottle of soda. She made me pay before she poured. Once I did, she narrowed her eyes and paused. If it was such a bad meal, why are you back here? I'd like to speak to the, it was probably best not to repeat Naomi's opening lines. Grace, I'd like to apologize. The bartender handed me my drink and went into the kitchen to tell Grace I was here. She returned minutes later and said Grace would be out shortly. 5 minutes turned to 10. 20. I waited. Couples left. Tables were cleared. Wait staff clocked off. The bartender was the last to leave, and I left a generous tip. The lights in the restaurant went dark, all except for a golden haze coming from the circular window in the kitchen door. Seconds later, it opened again. And there was Grace. Tired, arms folded. She stared at me. "I am so sorry," I said. I'd never said those words and meant them like I did then. She nodded once, then opened the other door, revealing a heap of dirty dishes. Now's your chance to prove it. In the kitchen, Grace handed me some sweaty rubber gloves and set me to work. I slotted hundreds of plates and pieces of cutlery into a giant dishwasher while scrubbing down spider burners and soaking enormous metal pots. I quickly realised I was doing the work of at least two people. Probably the two teenage boys who had run out of here 20 minutes earlier with their aprons over their shoulders and smiles on their faces. Grace moved around the kitchen as if she were choreographed for efficiency. Her hip would bump a drawer closed, while her arm would reach to switch off an extractor fan. She'd wipe down surfaces until they were shiny, then she'd open the fridge door with her foot and grab bunches of vegetables to prep for the next day. Watching her chop reminded me of some of the surgeons I'd worked with. The skill, the precision. It was unmatched. "Is this your restaurant?" I asked. "No," she said, with a hint of regret. "This restaurant belongs to the esteemed Jean-Paris Moreau. Did you not know that before you booked a table?" Heat rose to my cheeks. I didn't have a hope in hell of making myself look good tonight. My date chose the place. "My, my, you are a catch," she teased. "I deserved it. I'm surprised you had the guts to come back. The waiters were close to putting out a bounty on your head." "Why do you think I tipped so generously?" I could feel the death stares. "I guess that's the price you pay for not calling the girl you said you would, and then bringing someone else on a date to the restaurant she works in." "Oomph." The look she gave me was piercing. If I'd wondered whether she'd wanted me to call, if she'd been as into me as I was her, now I knew, for sure. "I know how bad that looks, but I swear I didn't know you worked here, and I've been busy." "You certainly looked like you had your hands full," she said, turning her back to me. She opened the dishwasher and the space between us filled with steam. She stacked the clean plates on the metal counter. I was 6 feet under, crawling through mud, desperate for air. The odds of me making it out alive were minuscule. "Okay, I'll level with you," I said, plunging the biggest saucepan I'd ever seen into soapy water. "I work shifts. My hours are all over the place. 5 a.m. starts, midnight finishes. I've just come off back-to-back nights and I can barely tell my arse from my elbow. I wanted to text you, but I swear the only time I've had a spare minute this week has been 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm eating a dry sandwich and convincing myself it's lunchtime. I didn't even have time to organise this date. My roommate did. And truth be told, I wanted to spend tonight on the sofa with David Attenborough, but instead I wound up on the worst date of my entire life." Grace raised an eyebrow. "David Attenborough? Nature geek. I have a stressful job. I find it calming." "Bet you're regretting that decision," she said. Not for a second. Her lips parted in surprise. "Because if I hadn't, I wouldn't be here with you right now." I kept my eyes on her until she saw how serious I was. Grace tried to fight the smile, but it spread across her mouth anyway. She hid it from me, turning back to the dishes. "Here," she said, handing me a frying pan lined with burnt-on grease. "Give that a scrub while I double-check the bar." It was half an hour later when I finally finished up. Grace was sitting on a bar stool waiting for me. She'd changed out of her chef whites and was wearing a soft-looking jumper with a black leather jacket. She looked utterly exhausted, but still gorgeous. Always gorgeous. "All done," I said. Grace walked past me, opening one of the swinging doors to inspect the kitchen. I don't know how it fared against her usual standards, but as far as I was concerned, it was spotless. I'd even mopped under the giant refrigerators. She gave me a satisfied nod. Have I made amends? For now, she said. As she moved by me again, our shoulders brushing, I stopped her. She looked up at me hesitant. I wondered if I should cut my losses. Consider this one of those awkward dating stories I'd retell when I was older, about the time I did the washing up of 60 people because my date went feral. But then Grace blinked, still not taking her gaze from me, the light in her eyes crystal blue, and the pang inside me said, "Not yet. Don't give up yet." "I'm really sorry, Grace. I'm not interested in being messed around." I shook my head. "No messing. Evidence would suggest otherwise. Let me make it up to you." She hummed doubtfully. "Please." She looked away first, smiling to herself as she grabbed her bag and a chunky set of keys from the bar. "Come on, Romeo. If I don't lock up before 12, the auto alarm sounds." Grace locked the front door of the restaurant, then pulled down a metal shutter. The street was quiet, a soft buzz of chatter and music coming from the bar down the road. I didn't wonder if Naomi was still inside. "Which way are you going?" she asked. I looked behind me as the black and gold high street clock struck midnight. "That way." She nodded at the medieval Westgate Museum. "I live up that hill. A literal crossroads." She twisted her keys in her hands. I rubbed my neck. "I work late," she said after a moment. "All the time. If you're looking for someone to curl up on the sofa to watch your nature shows with each night, I'm not your girl. I'm a chef, but that doesn't mean I want to be the one who always cooks dinner. My biggest fear is people thinking I'm a failure. I think it stems from school. I didn't test well, got called an idiot, and laughed at a lot. And I get jealous really easily. I'd say I'm working on that too, but tonight I told my colleague I want to drop a glass of red wine in your date's lap, so it's safe to say that's not going well." Her stare was serious. I understood what she was doing. Some kind of weird compatibility test. I was game. "I work like crazy because I need the money to buy a house," I said. "I've been saving since I turned 18. I've been called cheap more than once, but I don't care because owning a home is the only dream I've ever had. My hours change at the drop of a hat. We can curl up on the sofa in the morning instead. Or lunchtime. Whatever works. Night shifts make me grumpy and forgetful, but I'm working on it." I took a deep breath, struggling to know what to say, then realizing how sincere her confessions were. Brutal honesty. That's what it would take. "I'm 25, and I've never..." I paused. A small laugh to hide my nerves. Definitely failed. "I've never had a serious relationship." Grace was silent. "Not that I haven't had the opportunity. I've had plenty." "Not plenty." Shit. Putting yourself out there was painful. "I used to find it easier to keep things casual," I continued. "Less chance of being let down." I squirmed, realizing I could never unsay that. "You said used to," she said, interest sweeping across her face. "And now? Being let down by a girl like you would be a fucking honor." Grace pressed her lips together, looking up the hill as if it was calling her name. Then she fixed her eyes on me. I hate cats, she said. Got scratched by one as a kid, and now I think they're all out to get me. Fair, I said, sighing with relief that she didn't think me a head case. I have a recurring dream on being chased by a tiger. She said, I'm a vegetarian and think bacon is the worst thing I've ever tasted. Gross and overrated. I laughed. That is an abhorrent opinion, but I respect it. She narrowed her eyes, considering. I think granddad jumpers are sexy. Instantly adding them to my shopping list. The corner of her mouth ticked upward. Why do I get the feeling I could tell you that underneath my clothes I'm covered in scales and you'd still be interested? It's as if you know I grew up with Godzilla posters on my wall. The laugh fell out of her, transforming into a frustrated groan as she tilted her face to the starless night. This is so inconvenient. What is? A crush on a guy who's clearly dating around. I couldn't blame her for that impression of me, given the circumstances. Look, I said, sighing and stepping closer. I can't make you any promises. I can't tell you this will be something magical or incredible. But I know that I like you. And usually when I make a fool out of myself, I cut my losses and don't look back. But there's this little voice inside me telling me that this is different. That you're different. And that I'd be an idiot to not at least try. So, she sucked in a slow breath. Try with me? I said. Come what may. She was silent, watching my face closely but giving nothing away. What are you doing tomorrow night? I asked. I'm working. The next night? Also working. There wasn't a shred of regret in her voice. I could take a hint. Right, I said. I shoved my hands into my pockets. As much as it sucked, it was time to accept that I'd blown it. Grace was never going to give me a chance to prove myself, and I understood why. Well, sorry again for the whole rude date thing. And sorry for not calling. Got a feeling I'm going to be kicking myself over that one for a long time. I nodded, telling her to get home safely before turning to walk along the street. Next Friday, she called. I'm owed some annual leave. I turned to see her smiling. I mentally flicked through my calendar. I was on a late shift. Damn it. I'd swap. Mikkel owed me a favour for covering for him last Christmas Day. There was no way I was missing this chance. Next Friday, I said. 7 p.m. It's a date, she said, as if she was confirming after all we'd been through tonight that I wasn't only taking her out for a burger and a quick screw. Her eyes begged me not to make her regret this, and a heavy feeling washed through me. She knew I wasn't perfect. I knew it too. But it was in that very moment I promised myself that for her, I would never stop trying to be.
Chapter 8. Grace. Now. If seeing my restaurant reverted to its original state, and having the love of my life think I'm a stranger, wasn't enough to convince me that I'm 5 years in the past, then standing in front of Dottie's bungalow does it. The day I helped her move out of this house, I thought I'd never be here again. The new owners had big plans for this place, to build a ginormous extension, convert it into two stories. But as I stand on the roadside, It's like I've held up a grainy childhood photograph and it's dissolved into reality. In a street of red brick homes, Dottie once had me paint hers white for my monthly allowance. I painted the window frame sky blue 4 weeks later. "I want to be in Greece," she'd say, when I asked her why. "Every single day." My heart races as I step closer. Dottie has one of those old manual doorbells, the ones you twist that can be heard a mile away. When there's no answer, I tilt her Grecian naked lady statue, which has been a regular fixture on the neighbourhood watch agenda for years. The spare key is there, as it always was. I let myself in, calling her name to no reply. The setting sun reflects off the numerous crystals on her windowsill, next to a picture of her at the beach with her best friend, Althea. Matching cropped white hair and smiles ear to ear. Happier days. From the slow cooker comes the hearty aroma of a vegetable casserole. Sautéed onions, garlic, something unexpectedly sweet. It hits me straight in the heart. This is Dottie's cooking. No mistaking it. As soon as I started solids, I was eating that dish. I hear a bang come from the bathroom. A quiet yelp. Then, in standard Dottie style, obscenity. "Oh, bugger balls!" There's another moan, and my first thought is that she's hurt. I barge into the bathroom, and Dottie hollers like she's caught a rat, her arms wide, eyes full of horror. It makes me jump too, and then we're both screaming at each other, red-faced and hoarse. And I know I'm screaming because she is, and because she's here, healthy. Her energy is unmistakable, and not just because it's at a piercing decibel, but because she's bright and bubbly. She's not wearing her typical comfortable house clothes. She's head to toe in pink, a stylish blazer, and heels. "I thought you were hurt." I pull her into me, not at all bothered by the fact she's still trying to get her trousers up over her bum. "I didn't know if you were okay, if you'd be here, or..." "I bumped my elbow on the towel rail and you think I'm dead," she says. I squeeze her so tight she coughs. "Gracie Maeve, what on earth has gotten into you?" I shake my head in disbelief, staring into her blue eyes. It's the same sensation I had when I saw Henry. A savage type of shock. But unlike the party, there's no holding this back. "Something weird has happened."
"Weird?"
She pauses, washing her hands. Her favourite word.
"I'm listening."
"You know how you were sure the postman was stealing packages from you because his aura had changed?" I say, trying to find some kind of level ground that will make what I'm about to say sound halfway plausible.
"Well, that cheeky swine took my werewolf erotica,"
she says, with such vitriol I regret bringing it up. She moves past me to the hallway. I follow, surprised how fast I need to move to keep up.
"Okay, but I believed you. No questions asked, right?"
She nods, then sighs.
"What on earth is all this about? I have the kettle waiting."
"I think I've time-travelled back 5 years." Dottie doesn't react. Her eyes don't blink. The lines around her mouth are frozen. I keep going. "A few days ago, it was the night before my 30th birthday, and I was closing down my failed restaurant business, crying in a packed train station. You were..." My face twists in pain. "It was the worst day of my life. Everything had completely fallen apart, and I was so desperate to fix it, I drank a load of wine, got out all your crystals, and made a wish. The way we used to when I first started staying here. And the next thing I know, the moon looked like a giant cherry, and I'm face down on my kitchen floor, having some type of alcohol-induced fever dream. I woke up the next morning, and bam, I'm 25 again."
"Oh,"
she says. "Oh," I repeat. "You're acting like I've told you I'm going to dye my hair brown."
"Lord, no,"
she gasps in horror.
"It'll completely wash you out."
I exhale a laugh. "How does that warrant a bigger reaction than what I've just said?"
"Well, you can't fight genetics. Some of us were meant to be blondes. It's how the world works."
"Dottie." I put my hands over my face and resist the urge to scream. "What year is it?"
"According to whom?" The Gregorian calendar works very differently to the Julian one. And then there's the Chinese. According to you. Oh, it's the year I turned 75, she tells me. Right, but in the world as of a few days ago, you were almost 80. And you were... I was what? The vague phone call from my mother plays in the back of my mind. I wish I knew the answer to that question. You were older, I say. Well, that is generally how time works, my love. She sidles past me, making her way to the kitchen. I look around, searching for something that will prove to her that this is real, that I know what I'm talking about. There's a newspaper tucked behind a vase. I grab it. It's a couple of weeks old. Dottie only buys it for the quizzes in the back, but it'll prove my point. I point to the front page. This guy, I say, landing my index finger on a balding politician in his 60s. He'll be prime minister for about 2 months, then get sacked for having sex in his office. Dottie purses her lips, completely unsurprised. Must try harder. I flick to the next page, a big up-and-coming singer. She'll make a crazy successful album, then have twins, and get divorced. Then marry the hot guy from the perfume ad, the one that does that swooshing thing with his hair. I enact the motion, but Dottie only blinks at me. My eyes fall from her face to the crystal hanging around her neck. She says it's for love, but in about 4 years' time she'll admit to me that it's for healing. I know exactly how to convince her. Your heart, I say. You're having chest pains, shortness of breath, and you're putting it down to stress, to old age. But deep down you know something more is happening, that your heart doesn't feel like it's beating right, but you're too scared to do anything about it. Her mouth falls open. How? Because you told me, I say. Or you will, when it's too late to do anything about it. Dottie steps away until her back hits the counter. The kettle rumbles behind her. Well, she says. She's finally speechless. I am going to get it checked, she says, after a moment. I'm not going to ignore it. She did before. I didn't know about it until the manager of her assisted living centre accidentally let it slip that Dottie was taking aspirin daily. Dottie told me the truth after I confronted her, admitting she had been diagnosed with heart disease, that she'd suspected for years, but only knew for sure after moving into the home and having an angina attack so bad she couldn't stand. Thank goodness she was in reach of her red emergency pull cord. I dread to think what would have happened without it. I look around her kitchen. Maybe I could get one installed in here. Dottie narrows her eyes, as though she's trying to patch together a story that makes a shred of sense. You said you used my crystals, she says. The ones you've given me over the years. For strength, forgiveness, whatever you thought I needed. I put them all in a circle and told the universe what I wanted. Is that a thing? You always talk about magic. Could they have... This must have been something bigger, stronger, Dottie says. Crystals alone wouldn't do this. But you believe me? I say, full of relief. As if I would ever doubt the mysterious ways the world works, she smiles. But whatever it was, we really ought to get you checked over by a professional, just in case. I naturally think she means by a medical professional, but no. She's flicking through her little black book, trying to find the number of Coco, her Reiki or a tarot person, insisting I be cleansed as soon as possible. No, no, I'm fine, I swear, I say. Besides, I really don't want to bring anyone else in on this. It feels a little scary. I trust you. Understood, Dottie replies, putting aside her phone book and instead reaching for her crystals. She begins waving them in front of my face, over my chest, then doing ominous flicky things with her fingers. I'm not as good as I used to be, what with this arthritis and all, but I can make sure I rid you of any lingering bad vibes. Right, I say, fighting a laugh as she fusses with the air around me. What else do you remember from before? She asks, her movements getting bigger, more frantic. I'm not going to lie to her. You had a big falling out with Althea. She met someone, started going to Greece with him instead of you.
I kept telling you that her dating someone didn't need to change your friendship, but you took it so badly. Like she'd replaced you. After that, everything changed. You were sad and lonely. I tried to fill the gap, but you barely left the house. Your arthritis worsened, and then... There are a few medical pit stops I could take, but I'm highly aware of the way Dottie's gaze is falling to the floor, her petite shoulders rounding forward. But it doesn't have to be that way, I say. Now you know, you can stay close with Althea. You can go to the doctor. The silence is heavy. I did the right thing telling you, didn't I? I say. Of course, of course. Her expression lightens again. And what of you? What happened? I give her the full, unabridged truth of my business. How I started it way too young, before I had any real experience of what it was to run a restaurant. How I let my employees down, my investors. How I eventually, after 5 years of hard work, wound up bankrupt. Like my parents said I would. You don't have the business acumen to pull off something like this. Leave it to the experts and focus on poaching eggs and chopping onions. They weren't always so negative. There was once a time they thought I might be their prodigy. When they were in the country, I'd be forced to sit there for hours, homework splayed out in front of me.
If you only tried, come on, what is the square root of 99? It's easy!
Dad would shout, whacking my plastic ruler against the mahogany dining table until I got it right. I wanted so badly to impress them, to make them proud.
Businesses fail all the time, for lots of reasons. Dottie says, you know the saying, if at first you don't succeed.
It's not hard to see why, as I got older, I stopped making wishes for Mum and Dad to come home, and instead wished that I lived in this bungalow permanently, that Dottie was my real mother. Dottie was always lifting me up, always in my corner, always playing cheerleader. The only person, next to Henry, who truly believed I could do it. Failing again is not an option. It's fine. We don't need to hash it all out, I say. I'm not going to make that mistake again.
So what are you going to do?
When I shrug my shoulders, Dottie bangs her hands on the table, a huge smile on her face.
Why so defeatist? Grace, this is incredible. A gift. You have a second chance. People always ask those daft hypotheticals. What would you do differently if you could do it all again? Grace, my darling, you've got it. It's yours.
I wish I had her enthusiasm, but right now just the possibility of living through it all again makes me think doomsday preppers might be onto something. All I'm focusing on is getting you to the doctor, trying to make some sort of sensible career plan, and staying the hell away from Henry Dunn.
Henry Dunn?
She repeats. And I forget she has no idea who I'm talking about. I try to think how I can sum up the most meaningful, incredible, heartbreakingly torturous relationship I've ever known. In the end, all I can settle on is the love of my life. Well, my other life. Her eyes narrow. It's a sentiment I've never expressed before, referring to stick to casual descriptors such as the guy from the gym, the guy who cheated on me with his ex, and the one with the train set in his bedroom. It's not like they were ever around long enough for their names to stick. Let's just say, in the time before, I was sitting here gushing about this amazing man I'd met at a party, who was handsome and funny and charming, and how I was desperately waiting for him to call me, how it felt different with him, exciting. And now... Dottie must see the pain etched into my expression, because she reaches across the table to touch my arm. He hurt you, she says. Well, it's more complicated than that. I take a long breath and see the moment I knew I was in love with him. One dimly lit morning as he crawled out of bed for his shift, but not before bringing me breakfast, kissing me slow, and telling me he was counting down the minutes until he'd be back between my sheets. And then, of course, the memory that always follows. The unimaginable, bitter end. I haven't spoken about it in over 4 years. I thought it was supposed to get easier. I'm still waiting. I saw him last night, I say. Met him for the first time again. I went there thinking I could handle it. But one look at him and it all came screaming back. The heartache. I see his hand wrapped around the redheads and the jealousy burns my insides. It's proved to me that I can't go through that again, I say. Dottie stands to make two cups of tea. There's a saying I heard years ago, always stuck with me, she says, musing as she stirs. Don't look for me in the person you met yesterday. She returns to the table, watching me closely. She slides over a mug. What does that even mean?
It means the past versions of me aren't here anymore. That we're always changing, evolving. The people who knew me at 20 wouldn't recognize me now. And not only because of the lines on my face, and that everyone over 70 is wearing some type of bifocal, but because I'm different. I'm mature, more patient, wiser.
Don't laugh.
I didn't, I insist. You are the wisest person I know. Why do you think I came here?
She smiles, satisfied.
The point is, you are not the same person you were 5 years ago. I can see now. You are not the same Grace who was sitting here last week moaning about your job at Le Bleu. But he is the same guy, I say. Well, it doesn't mean that things have to go the same way they did before. You know better. You could change it. But should I? I say. Instead of wishing for an altered ending, maybe I shouldn't start the story.
Dottie looks confused.
But if you truly believe he's the love of your...
There'll be others, I say. With so much certainty, it surprises me. The thought of opening my heart for someone else the way I did for Henry feels inconceivable. But I have to believe it's theoretically possible eventually, even if I don't right now. Besides, last night he looked very happy with someone else, and maybe that's how things are supposed to be. The only thing I have time to worry about is you. When the slow cooker buzzes, we get to cooking, adding the finishing touches to her infamous casserole. I add some fresh herbs. She moves for a pinch more salt. I block her with my hand.
Think of the flavour, she says.
Think of your heart, I counter. She nods, accepting a small change, a step in the right direction. And then, as we sit and eat and talk some more, I think of my own heart, cracked, scarred, still full of Henry, and wonder if some things will ever change.
Chapter 9. Henry. 5 years earlier. A Friday in March. There have been thousands of them. 100 in my lifetime alone. But this one I was going to remember for the rest of my life. I checked my watch for the 50th time. 26 minutes until I was meeting Grace for our first date. I stood restless in front of my bedroom mirror. It felt like every finger had morphed into an unopposable thumb. Buttons stuck between threads. Creases formed as I went from navy shirt to white shirt to black shirt. Repeat. I'd barely eaten all day. Couldn't stop checking my phone. I knew exactly what this meant. I was nervous as hell. Ali lay at the end of my bed, resting on her elbow with a folder of legal papers spread out before her. She giggled as I huffed and puffed. I sprayed more deodorant. I checked my teeth for spinach I hadn't eaten in weeks. "You look perfectly adequate," she said. "Stop fussing." I glared at her reflection in the mirror. "Is there a reason you're not working in the living room, or your own bedroom, or the roof?" I said. "Anywhere but here." "Because everywhere in this house still smells like stale beer, except for your room, where I'm drowning in the thick scent of antiperspirant." Her exaggerated cough transformed into a laugh. "If someone had tidied up properly after the house party, it wouldn't smell at all," I replied. "Or better yet, chosen a different venue." I put on a grey shirt and she frowned. "White, definitely white," she said. I was so exhausted from another grueling week on the ward, I was convinced the white made me look like I'd crawled out of the morgue. But Ali had far better style than I did, so I took her advice and put the white one on instead. I reached for a tie. "No tie!" she shouted, looking up from the paper she was highlighting. I fiddled with the collar. It didn't look right. Maybe I should iron it again. I had no idea why this felt so monumental. It was a first date. I'd had enough of them. Drinks after work with a few colleagues, some blind dates, a couple of dating app matches, none of which turned into anything serious, their decision as much as mine. There had never been any kind of magic. I felt wanky for saying that, for dismissing perfectly lovely women because there was something unquantifiable about them that didn't click. I was a man of medicine. I knew how the biological heart worked. But the proverbial one? I had no idea. "Where are you taking her?" Ali asked. "I've got a table booked for that Italian in town. Aren't you worried a sit-down meal is too formal? What if she's expecting a quiet drink?" I froze. I thought the idea was to wine and dine. Make an effort. Don't tell me I've got it all wrong minutes before I walk out the door. Her lips pursed together in a confident smile. "Oh, you like her, she chimed. I couldn't fight the smile that pulled at the corners of my mouth. "You are so smitten. You spoke to her for, what, 10 minutes? "Well, yeah. And also for about 2 hours after my disaster date with Naomi." Ali sat up, putting the lid on her pen and staring at me. "You never told me that." I had told her about Naomi. I mean, she was going to hear Naomi's version of it anyway. But I'd left out the part about Grace being there. I don't know why. I guess I wasn't ready for it to be a story that got told yet. I wanted it to still be unfolding. I felt bad for Naomi being rude, so I helped Grace finish her shift after the restaurant closed. "And we've been texting, too," I said. "About? Getting to know you stuff. She's incredibly smart and so funny. And I couldn't believe it. She loves..." Ali was gawking at me with a goofy smile. "What?" "I'll bet you're in love with her by the end of the night." "Jesus, it's a first date. Give me some credit." "Nope, nuh-uh. It's written all over your face. You're in love." "Oh, piss off." I grabbed my aftershave from the shelf and turned my back to her so she wouldn't see the heat spreading across my cheeks. Damn these lawyers and their x-ray perception. £50 says you're still on this date tomorrow morning," she said. "Nope. Not doing this. It's fine to bet on whether the milk has expired, but I draw the line at my love life." All right. Ali shuffled her notes into a pile and leaned against my doorway on her way out. "But I stand by it. When the clock strikes midnight..." She made a quick succession of kissy noises and I closed the door in her face. £50, she called from the landing. "Fine," I replied, just to put an end to it. The restaurant was a walking cliché, with checked tablecloths and candles melted down to the wax-covered holder. And so was I, waiting outside, checking my phone every few minutes, convinced my luck was about to run out and Grace was going to cancel. She didn't. She appeared from around the corner, bundled into a dark coat, a woolly bobble hat on her head. "Oh God, am I late?" she said, breathless. She pulled off her hat and ran a hand through her messy golden waves. "I'd happily wait for you," I replied, fearing she'd know I meant it in more ways than one. She smiled and hugged me, as though we were old friends. and as I held her close to me for the first time, the coconut scent of her hair under my nose, I could have sworn my heart skipped a beat. It didn't. I knew it was most likely an adrenal impact on my heart's electrical activity. But right then, I understood exactly what that saying meant. Like, holding her in my arms could pause time, alter biology, change lives. Oh man, I was so screwed. When the waiter brought the wine list and I told her I didn't really drink alcohol, it was as natural as mentioning I didn't like bananas. She made no fuss, asked no questions. She ordered the tagliatelle because it had a to-die-for sauce that I had to try. And so I did. When the food came, she told me in exact detail what she loved about it, how the balance of ingredients could change an entire dish. She had me, a guy who thought a fry-up was lavish, feeling as if I knew the difference between basil and bay leaf. Somehow this girl made food taste better. What made you want to become a chef? My grandmother, she replied. I lived with her on and off when I was growing up. Picture those mad inventors in cartoons, that's her in the kitchen. She'd throw all sorts into a big pot and cook it down. Sounds adventurous. A lot of the time it was an assault on the taste buds. She'd tell me it was casserole for dinner and I'd be filled with terror because I knew it meant a hodgepodge of whatever was in the cupboard, but she revelled in it. Grace paused to take a big bite of pasta, chewed and swallowed. I loved how messy and human the process was. Food flying across the kitchen, a sprinkle of this, a dash of that. But it was always fun, you know? No matter what, she had this unwavering confidence that it would work out. And did it? I asked. She smiled as if reminiscing. I can't recall ever getting food poisoning as a kid, so I'm going to say yes. What about you? She added. What made you want to become a nurse? Thank you. Her laugh was quiet and confused. For what? Most people assume I failed to become a doctor. They never think I actually chose nursing. That's quite sad. I know. I paused while I thought of how to word what came next. At school, I'd always been good at science. I liked the stability of it, that no matter what,